This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We don't know much about the childhood of Mayberry's fictional sheriff, Andy Taylor, but it probably wouldn't have been much different than that of the man who created him. Andy Griffith was born in Mount Airy, North Carolina. He was an only child. He sang in the church choir and he swept floors at school. And though he had talent and good looks, nobody from that town would have guessed that he was to become a famous movie and TV star, and one who would bring the tenderness of his hometown to the world through television. Andy Griffith had a long career on TV, in music, on stage, and in film, and he meant many things to many people. Today, we celebrate the life of North Carolina's native son, and we remember Andy Griffith. And joining me first is Neil Brower. Neil is the writer of Mayberry 101, behind the scenes of a TV classic. He's also a Methodist minister who leads an Andy Griffith Bible study. Neil, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell me first about Andy's childhood in Mount Airy. What would that have been like?
Andy was born on June 1st, 1926, and this is an interesting fact. That's the exact same day and year that Marilyn Monroe was born. So they have the exact same birthday and same year. Andy grew up in small town of Mount Airy. His father ran a bandsaw at one of the furniture factories there. Andy was not a good student in school, not very athletic, and really found a passion for life and a direction for life when he discovered music.
What kind of music was he interested in?
He liked big band swing music, and he saw a movie when he was a boy, 14. It's called Birth of the Blues. It starred Bing Crosby. It had a slide trombone player named Jack Teagarden in it. And Mr. Teagarden, I've never seen this, but I understand he took the slide off his trombone and then put a water glass over that portion of the trombone, and Andy thought it was the greatest thing he ever had seen. So he decided he wanted to learn how to play the trombone, began sweeping the school, as you mentioned in your intro, for a few dollars a week, saved up $33 and ordered a trombone from the Spiegel catalog.
Boy, I'm glad you said Birth of the Blues. You had me really worried there for a minute as the seminal influence in his life. There was another artist who really moved him, whose name would then find its way onto the Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah, that was a fellow named Opie Cates. I think he was a clarinet player, again, with swing music. He was a big favorite of Andy's when the series, The Andy Griffith Show, started. The writers, producers asked Andy, would you like to have any input with naming the son? And Opie was from Opie Cates, C-A-T-E-S, and Andy honored his favorite musician with that naming.
Did he play much music as a student?
Interesting enough, once he got the trombone, there was no place to go to learn how to play it in the school. There was no band in Mount Airy at that time. Andy heard there was a new Moravian minister who had moved into Mount Airy. His name was Ed Mickey. He was a Moravian minister. Moravian churches a lot of times have brass bands, and Reverend Mickey was giving lessons to his congregation. Andy rode his bicycle 2 miles carrying his trombone. Reverend Mickey had a lot of students, so he tried to discourage Andy, but Andy was back the next week for his 1 week, his lesson once a week, and he had such determination and such just love for music that he was an inspiration to the other people in the church band. Andy then began to take some singing lessons with Reverend Mickey. He also learned how to play some of the other instruments in the band, as well as guitar. So once he found that music ability, then he began to perform in church and sing in some of the perhaps civic groups in Mount Airy, and really found something that turned his life around. Andy was not a very good student. In fact, he failed the third grade. And when he found music, he found something that he could take pride in and that gave him some notoriety.
Kind of interesting to imagine that his teachers were always trying to encourage this guy who wasn't much for book learning, and his music teacher discouraged him, and that's the way he went anyway, music and then on into the life of a performer. Though almost the life of a minister, that Moravian minister had another influence on him. Tell us about that.
Okay, when he decided it was time to go to college, when he graduated in 1944, he went to UNC, Carolina, to study for the Moravian ministry. His major was in sociology. He had taken some Latin classes, Greek, and he was getting ready to take Hebrew, and he said, this is just not for me. I don't enjoy it. I miss my music. So he saw a advertisement for a Gilbert and Sullivan play that was going to be put on by the students there on campus. And he tried out and got a part and went and talked to the Moravian Bishop in Winston-Salem. And the Moravian Bishop said, you've either got to go the minister route, not music, or make another decision about being a minister. So Andy did and went back to what he was happy with, his love for music.
Any indication that that was a very difficult choice for him, or how did that go?
I really don't know. I would think it would be a very easy choice. He missed his music. He wanted to embrace that. He was good enough to get a role in the Gilbert and Sullivan play. He made friends there, and I imagine that he was very much encouraged by the director there at UNC, because in the summer of 1947, that director, and I'm sorry, I don't know his name, he was also working at the Lost Colony in Manio and invited a group of students to go out for some minor roles in the Lost Colony. Andy was one of the students. I was looking over some information before I came on your show, and Andy said, I was 21. I had never seen the ocean before. I got a part, five lines, as a soldier, and I got paid $25 a week.
And not only that, not only was it a new horizon for him or a new vista, but those bus rides back and forth, or the bus ride back and forth, allowed him the opportunity to apply a new craft. He started writing on those bus trips, or at least entertaining on those bus trips, huh?
That's right. The students and perhaps some of the adult actors there, I understand there was a Navy base there near Manio, and there was some Kwanzaa huts. And the students would stay there. It was a drive from there to the theater where the Lost Colony was performed. And to entertain themselves, some of the students on the bus would sing. Andy perhaps sang. He also got a split-tail coat and put it on and began doing kind of a comedy routine about a Southern minister. And would write jokes and share them with the people as they would ride on the bus to the Lost Colony each night.
And this led to what's going to bring him finally to national attention, which is his ability as a monologist. He writes monologues, right?
It will eventually. Now, when he graduated from UNC, it took him 5 years to get through. So he graduated in 49. That when he graduated from school, he interviewed with several school systems. I know he interviewed with Chatham County. That's where Siler City is located, so that's one reason you hear Siler City named on the show. Andy said, I almost live there, so I'm going to use it on the show. But he actually got hired to teach music and diction in Goldsboro, North Carolina. He and his wife, Barbara, and they moved to Goldsboro and worked there for 3 years.
As a teacher.
And Andy was a teacher and a choir director at First Baptist Church in Goldsboro.
Best but I can always, tell, yeah, he didn't like either side of the desk in the school, in the classroom, did he?
No, he said, I wasn't a very good teacher. I told him everything I knew the first week, and then I was in trouble.
So he does start writing monologues at some point. How did that happen?
All right, when he decided that he and his wife, Barbara, would try to make a go of it, and he quit his school job, he first went to New York in early 1952, and actually auditioned to be a classical singer. And he was told that his voice was too brilliant. And he went back home and appeared in the Lost Colony that summer. And he had now gotten the role of Sir Walter Raleigh. And then he began to appear in the South for civic groups. Any place he could find a job for, he and his wife, he would tell comedy monologues. Some of these were based on Shakespeare, the early ones. And Andy did that. He said it was really a therapy for him, because he was always afraid of Shakespeare in school. And now he could take it and turn it around and make fun of it and kill two birds with one stone, come up with a great monologue and kind of just make fun of something he was scared of.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of a clip of a monologue he did on Hamlet.
And it was right there that Hamlet gave that soliloquy about being or not being. Well, for them that don't know, a soliloquy is a kind of a self-talk. You know, it is where you kindly, you know, sit and look away off and kindly talk to yourself. And that's what he was a-doing. Only he wasn't sitting down, he was walking. And when he come close to the end of it, he come up on this young girl, Ophelia. And he says to himself, he says, soft. I see Ophelia fine. Well, he sat down and started talking to her. Asked her how she was and how her daddy was and how her mama was and different ones. And while he was talking, he looked and he seen a fella hiding behind a cedar chest. And he did, and he took out his sword, and he run the fella. He run him upstairs, and he run him downstairs. But he couldn't catch him, and it made him mad, and he come back to Ophelia, mad at her. And he hit her in the face, and he throwed her on the ground. And he says, "Get thee to a nunnery, for thy face is a vile thing before my eyes." Now, it was right here that Hamlet first started acting like that he wasn't all that.
Andy Griffith on Hamlet. And, of course, Neil Brower, the one that brought him to national attention was a bit called What It was football, right?
That's right. And that routine actually developed because Andy's wife had booked two shows before the same group. And Andy had to come up with a new routine. He was driving from Chapel Hill to Raleigh. That's where the engagement was. And he remembered what he had seen. He played in the school band, pep band at UNC for 2 years. He remembered what he observed when he would go to the football games. And then he thought of a dirty joke that someone in Chapel Hill who ran a hardware shop had told him. And he combined the two, took out anything that was dirty, and came up with what it was football. And an interesting tidbit about that, it was actually recorded in the fall of 1953 at a Jefferson Standard Insurance annual meeting. And Andy also told Romeo and Juliet, and that's the B-side of that original What It was Football 45. Well, that night when it was actually recorded live, Romeo and Juliet got a much bigger laugh and response at the end than What It was football. So when Capitol Records put that out, they used the response for Romeo and Juliet at the end of What It was football.
Well, What It was football managed to sell more than a million. We'll talk more about the life and legacy of Andy Griffith on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.
The fishing hole, I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.
This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking about the life of Andy Griffith and now getting into his career as a performer. We're talking with Neil Brower. He's a Methodist minister, author of Mayberry 101, Behind the Scenes of a TV Classic. Joining us now is Mary Dalton. Mary's a professor of communication at Wake Forest University. She co-edited the sitcom Reader, America Viewed and Skewed. Mary, welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So we talked about his early career. He's a monologist. He has this bit called What It was Football, sold a lot of records. People start knowing the name of Andy Griffith. We all know it from the show, The Andy Griffith Show, and then Matlock. But in between was a film that was critically acclaimed, although not terribly popular, A Face in the Crowd. What? Tell us about that movie.
Well, it's a hard-edged kind of story. It was directed by Alia Kazan and written by Bud Schulberg, who had done On the Waterfront. So that's a great legacy to have. And it's a story about a guy, Larry Rhodes, who becomes known as Lonesome Rhodes, who's a drifter in Arkansas. And a producer, a radio producer, hears him singing in jail and puts him on the radio. And it takes off from there, and he ends up with a television show. And he's not a nice guy. You know, he presents this great folksy kind of persona, but evil lurks behind that facade.
No, he becomes a demagogue. And so tell us about this character, because, man, it is not Andy Taylor.
No, not at all. I mean, he lies. He cheats. He, you know, his moral compass is definitely skewed. And he uses, though, that folksy persona and his musical ability to lead people, and to lead people in ways that are not in their best interests.
And this film is produced when?
1957. But it feels topical.
It feels very topical today. Here's this guy who is going to pick up on all kinds of resentment and lead people, and is very self-conscious about how he does it. We've got a clip now. Here's Andy Griffith from the film A Face in the Crowd.
Rednecks, crackers, hillbillies, housefrows, shut-ins, pea pickers. Everybody that's got to jump when somebody else blows the whistle. They don't know it yet, but they're all gonna be fighters for Fuller. They're mine. I own them. They think like I do. Only they're even more stupid than I am, so I gotta think for them. Marsha, you just wait and see. I'm going to be the power behind the president, and you'll be the power behind me.
There we go. Andy Griffith from A Face in the Crowd. So how did it do? Critically, it did pretty well, didn't it?
Well, there were some mixed reviews at the beginning, but over time, it's you know, really been on the ascendancy in terms of the critical response to the film.
How about in the popular judgment?
You know, well, you haven't seen it. So that's pretty I mean, a lot of people have not seen this film. And if nothing more happens today than a bunch of people go out and look at A Face in the Crowd, I think we've done a good thing. Because Andy Griffith's performance has tremendous depth. And it's so completely different from Andy Taylor, that I think it shows what we might have seen if there had been more of those roles that came
and
its way.
Certainly it predates Andy Taylor.
Yes.
So Sky was the limit. Elia Kazan is the guy who discovers Marlon Brando. Here comes Andy Griffith on the scene with this powerful role. What did it do for him professionally?
Well, I don't know that it did too much. I mean, he continued with the music. He continued with the comedy. I'm not as much an expert on his personal history, but he did come to the attention of some of the producers with the Danny Thomas show, and he's able to do an appearance on that show that the character is introduced that leads then to the pilot episode and the series that we know, the Andy Griffith Show.
And before that, Neil Brower, Andy Griffith went to New York and had some success on Broadway, didn't he?
Yes, he appeared in Broadway on in the play No Time for Sergeants. This would have been right before A Face in the Crowd. Then after A Face in the Crowd, he actually did the film version of No Time for Sergeants. And just a short time after that, another movie called Onion Head. And by the way, Turner Classic Movies are showing all these movies tonight. It's Andy Marathon.
Yeah.
So it's you have great timing. But after Onion Head, No Time for Sergeants was very popular, but Onion Head was not. And Andy was pretty frustrated. He wasn't getting any movie offers. Andy wanted to be another Jimmy Stewart or Glenn Ford. And the movie offers just didn't come in. He wasn't very proud of his work. And he contacted William Morris Agency through his manager, Richard Lincoln, and said, let's see what we can do on TV.
Yeah, and you can tell he's moving in that direction. He was on a program called What's My Line, which would usually get people off the street, but there was always a guest interviewer or a guest on the show who was an up-and-coming star, and Andy Griffith makes it to the show.
They're having singing tryouts over at the town hall. Why don't you go sing for them?
Well, anyway, he was on What's My Line as an up-and-coming star, promoted that way, and here's how it sounded.
All right, panel, as you know, and we have our mystery guest before us, we go to a different form of questioning. You will ask one question at a time, in turn, moving clockwise, and we'll begin with Miss Arlene Francis.
Would your name and picture appear in the entertainment pages of the newspapers?
Yes, Mr. Sir.
Have you ever displayed your talents, which I'm sure are manifold, in a nightclub?
Yes.
Do you sing?
Beautifully.
Are you appearing in the newest hit in town, Destry Rides Again?
Yes.
Are you Andy Griffith?
Yes, sir.
Now, those appearances on programs like that, of course, very well managed. The manager wants to get you on the show. The show wants to profile somebody who's up and coming. So Neil, it sounds like he was working really hard to make sure those roles kept coming and those offers kept coming. Is that right?
He had really worked hard before he went back to New York and had some success doing South and Southwest circuit. And he said, that is where I really learned my craft. He did so many shows a week and knew how to really control an audience and how to be a professional entertainer.
So tell us how he came to do the Andy Griffith Show.
Okay. As I said, William Morris was contacted to see what they could do for Andy on TV. And Sheldon Leonard was a producer of many of the Desi Lu produced comedies. This would be Dick Van Dyke, The Joey Bishop Show. And Danny Thomas had a show. Sheldon was the producer of that show. And his idea was to bring Andy on, and the show was broadcast in January of 1960. Now, this would have been Destry Rides Again was on Broadway, so that began in April of 59 and ran through the summer of 60. So Andy took a couple weeks off, and he went to Los Angeles and appeared in an episode of Make Room for Daddy, or The Danny Thomas Show. And it showed what he would be like if he perhaps did get a series, and some of the people that he would interact with. General Foods was the sponsor for The Danny Thomas Show, and they have first rights if they wanted to pick up this pilot as a new series in the fall. And immediately, the executives of that company liked what they saw, and they said, we want to start this in the fall on CBS. And The Andy Griffith Show began production when Destry Rides Again closed in July, and they produced about five or six episodes before the October 3rd premiere.
So now in that appearance on The Danny Thomas Show, he plays everything. He is the town's, right, he's the judge, he's the sheriff, and he's the town clerk, and just about anything else you can imagine. He's got three roles in town, right?
He's also the editor of the town newspaper. And the original idea for that that pilot and what Andy's show would be about is that Andy would be, again, this is based on his monologue history, Andy would tell funny stories about the people in the town. And Andy said if we'd have gone in that direction, it would have lasted about 2 weeks. And somebody stepped in and really changed the direction.
And so tell us about the first season and tell us how Don Knotts, because originally it was going to be, you know, Andy was going to be the centerpiece of the show. No Don Knotts,
right,
no deputy.
Don Knotts is the someone who stepped in and really changed things. When Andy was on Broadway with No Time for Sergeants, Don had a minor part in the Broadway production as a psychologist. They struck up a friendship, and Don was at home. There is no deputy in the pilot episode. Don saw the Danny Thomas pilot at home, and sometime over the summer when he heard that Andy had got picked up for a new series, he called Andy up and said, Andy, what do you think about the possibility of having a deputy? And Andy said, I never thought about that, but I think it's a good idea. Call Sheldon Leonard and share this with him. So Don did, and really created his own role. Sheldon said, I think you could play the part and do it beautifully. And right off the bat, this was even before they went on the air, they had five or six scripts filmed, and they realized that something needed to change, that Don, as Barney Fife, was going to be the funny one, and Andy would be the straight man. And that worked. In fact, the very first episode is called The News Housekeeper. There was a big debate between the producers of The Griffith Show and CBS whether that should be the very first episode or not. They wanted Manhunt, which is episode number two, that features more of a comic light on Don Knotts. But CBS finally made the decision to go with The Housekeeper because it was more of a family-centered show.
And Mary Dalton, that relationship between the two, that relationship between Andy Griffith, who is a widower, mm-hmm. right, and Don Knotts, it becomes a kind of the centerpiece. We focus on that. That's important to us.
Well, and I think it conveys a lot of the values of the show because we see how kind Andy is. He might pick at Barney, but he doesn't really let anybody else pick at Barney, and in fact tries to kind of boost his reputation whenever he gets a chance.
There's a wonderful episode where Barney wants to become, he's going to practice, and he wants to be chosen for Mayberry's Ladies League musicale, and he's rehearsing for it. And of course, he's awful. He's making all kinds of noise, and Andy's doing everything he can to be patient. So we see Barney practicing, and in comes this dirt farmer with overalls and a two-day growth on his face, carrying a bushel of green beans. And he hears Barney practicing, and he offers to give him a few tips. And turns out he can sing pretty darn well, and he sings a whole song. And afterward, old Andy makes a suggestion.
They're having singing tryouts over at the town hall. Why don't you go sing for them?
Oh, I couldn't do that.
Why not?
Because
he just couldn't. That's why. You're right to refuse, Rafe. I'm surprised at you, Andy.
Well, what's wrong?
Well, what's wrong is that Rafe don't have no trained singing voice. That's what's wrong. Suppose they was to ask you, can you sing a cappella? Would you know what to do?
No.
Well, there you are. Why get up and embarrass yourself?
Hey, Barney. Suppose they asked you if you can sing a cappella. What do you do?
Well, I do it. A cappella, a cappella. I don't know the rest of the words.
I see. Barney, I think all they want is to find out how good a voice you got. Now, why don't you take Rafe over there and have him sing for him?
You want Rafe here to be embarrassed and humiliated? They want people up there with musical backgrounds.
Hmm? It was just an idea.
I don't mean you have to stop singing, Rafe. You just go ahead and do it. You sing in the bathtub, don't you? Well, you can go right ahead and do that.
Can I ask a question?
What is it, Rafe?
What time are these here tryouts?
Right about now, guess what?
I'm going over there.
Huh?
Well, I reckon that since they ain't never around when I'm taking a bath, I best go on over there.
Go with him, Barn. Go on with him. Maybe on the way over there, you can teach him how to sing a cappella. How's that go again? A cappella, a cappella. That's catchy.
Kind of catchy. There is Andy Griffith in an episode that I think demonstrates pretty well their relationship. How about Andy as a straight man? I mean, did he have to – he played that role pretty well, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Everybody sort of circulates around him. And unlike other sitcoms, it's not joke-driven. You know, it's situational and character-driven. So it's a different sort of dynamic. And I think the town of Mayberry is really one of the characters, too. I mean, this is this kind of synergy that's created that makes the show kind of timeless.
It does. And what about and other relationships as well? How did the show get set in North Carolina? Mary? Or Neil, maybe you want to take that one.
Okay. When the show started out, it was just to be somewhere in the South. Andy had a Southern accent, and it was just placed in the South. And as scripts came in, perhaps they would talk about going to Capital City. And Andy said, I hate that. He said, I always hated it when they would use these generic names on shows I would watch. So let's make it Raleigh. Or next time they talk about town, let's make it Siler City. Or instead of Pilot Mountain, let's switch that and make it Mount Pilot. And then it became North Carolina, not intentionally, but generally. And after they had mentioned these names for a while, it became Mayberry, North Carolina.
And it is a fictional town, and it's not just the names. Mary, how does it feel so real to us, that town?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting something Neil said earlier, that Andy was interested in being a Jimmy Stewart type of character. So I think the show has this balance of specificity with these names, names that we actually really recognize. But other than that, the show is really general. And in fact, it almost felt nostalgic in the 60s. So, I mean, if you wanted to think about comparing it to some maybe a Frank Capra movie or something, there's a sense in which it almost feels more like the 30s than the 60s. And in fact, Mayberry doesn't look like any southern town in the real 60s because it's not dealing with any of those issues that were going on.
You know, it's interesting because both Don Knotts and Andy Griffith were on the Today Show talking about a couple of these elements that you just mentioned, both the town and the timing and the pace, the way the jokes worked.
Well, though we never said it, and though it was shot in the 60s, it had a feeling of the 30s. It was when we were doing it of a time gone by. And we were very careful to keep our characters always very pure. If a joke made a lie out of the character, we'd lose the joke.
Yeah, Andy used to say, if it sounds like a joke, throw it out.
So those are those two elements you're talking about, setting it in the kind of the 30s without any of the markers of the 30s and yet giving us that nostalgic feel. And no jokes. And, I went back after I heard that clip and listened, and I realized for the first time that they weren't really jokes. Where's the humor in that, Mary? How's it working for us?
Well, structurally, there are some other devices. There are setups and payoffs, and then there are funny situations. But again, it's really character-driven. I mean, there are funny things about Barney. And the fact that you have Andy who can sort of exploit those in the office, but then yet be Barney's number one protector. And then there are also very many tender moments. It's not all funny. If you've seen Opie the Birdman or some of those other episodes, they really bring a tear to the eye.
And of course, Andy is not married. He's widowed. He has a son. And his relationship with Opie and with women and the women in his life, we're going to talk about that because he's had at least three girlfriends. But let's listen to Andy and Opie together.
I got another little something to tell you. Looks like Aunt B might be getting married pretty soon.
Who's she going to marry?
Mr. Goss.
Is he going to marry her too?
Mm-hmm. That's generally the way it's handled. When somebody marries you, the polite thing to do is marry them right back.
Why do people get married, Paul?
Oh, a lot of reasons. Have a home, family, be together. I guess mainly because they love one another.
Does Aunt B love Mr. Goss?
Yes, she does.
Does that mean that she don't love us no more?
No, she loves us too.
Kind of confusing, ain't it?
Well, see, you can love a whole lot of people. The more the better. See, that's the regular kind of love. And it's a fine, fine thing.
But then you meet that special person, and you got a special love all saved up for them. That's the marrying kind of love. And that's the very best kind. Because it comes from way down deep inside of your heart.
Did you and Mom have that deep down kind?
Yes, son, we did.
And does Aunt Bee have that kind now?
Yes, she does.
Then it's all right, ain't it?
Yes, son, I expect it's all right.
And it's going to stay all right. What about that decision to make him a widower and to give him a son? Why not a wife?
Well, it creates a lot of other dramatic opportunities later on in the series. And actually, my favorite of his girlfriends is Ellie, the pharmacist, from early on, because she's the most independent. She's kind of an interesting character. I mean, as a young woman who's a pharmacist, but she runs for town council and she does all of these other things. I think she challenged Andy's character in ways, though, that maybe were not that comfortable.
Just
for
a little
him.
Too independent, yeah. Huh? For the 1960s. I mean, to be a pharmacist in the South in 1960 and a woman. And then he had another girlfriend who was a nurse, played by a couple of actresses.
Yeah, and I always thought that was interesting because there's this episode where they're trying to go on this date to Myers Lake to be alone, and Barney keeps interrupting. And even watching it then, I kind of thought, that doesn't really seem like Andy. It's almost like TMI for Andy. I don't want to know about him at Myers Lake with Nurse Mary.
We'll find out how they sculpted those characters and Mayberry and beyond to Matlock and a career that has spanned many decades as we look back at the life of Andy Griffith on the show today. More of our conversation on the state of things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the life of Andy Griffith with Neil Brower and Mary Dalton. Neil, a Methodist minister and author of Mayberry 101, Behind the Scenes of a TV Classic. Mary's a professor of communication at Wake Forest University. She co-edited the sitcom Reader, America Viewed and Skewed. And Mary, you know, in that clip we played just before the break, Opie and Andy, their relationship was not as formulaic as many in the sitcoms of the 60s, right?
No, well, you know, in the time period, the dad in sitcoms was a bumbling sort of character, and of course that wasn't Andy. You know, Andy is this, you know, steadfast, common sense, very bright center. But there are a few times in the episode where he is human, and he makes mistakes that are related to his relationship with Opie. And I think they just deepen the character. Opie will tell him something in an episode like Opie's Charity or Mr. McBeavy, where he just can't believe, he thinks, you know, he can't believe his son. He can't believe that he's not giving to the charity for a good reason. He can't believe that this man walks on trees. And yet when he really listens and investigates and finds out what Opie's really up to, then Andy has some humility and understands that his son has taught him an important lesson.
It was a wildly successful program, and it went on for 8 years, didn't it, Neil?
Yes, it from 1960 to 1968, CBS wanted to continue, but Andy was ready to seek a movie career at that point, and he made a deal with CBS to do a spinoff called Mayberry RFD, which lasted for 3 years and was in the top 20 all 3 years.
So, in fact, that came as a surprise to Don Knotts, because originally Andy was going to be out in five, and Don didn't know that he changed his mind, right?
That's right. Now, Don ended his time on The Griffith Show in 1965. This would have been the end of the black and white years, and then there were 3 years of color with Andy and the other characters. When Andy and Don began the series, Andy told him, I'm going to do this for 5 years, and then I'm going to pursue something else. And they were good friends, so this is kind of hard to understand. But at the end of the fifth season, Don was very popular, and of course Andy was too, but Don was such a comic presence on TV that he got a great deal with Universal to make these movies like The Shakiest Guns in the West, The Ghost and Mr. Chicken. And Andy did not get the same offers from movie studios. Mm. So Andy came back to Don and said, Don, At the end of the 65 year, I want to come back next year. And Don said, look, Andy, I wish you would have told me this. He said, I've got a verbal commitment that I've made to Universal, and it's just too good. I can't come back next year.
Well, eventually he did go on, Andy Griffith, to play another country sort, and that was his role as the lawyer Matlock, right, Neil?
Yes, that would have been a little bit later in 1983. The right. Griffith Show, as far as his time on it, started in 68, right. And Andy did a lot of, in fact, he had a series called The New Andy Griffith Show that in the middle of the season was not doing well, and they changed the character premise and named it Headmaster.
Of course, Andy had quite a bit of control over that show. That was one of the more interesting things about it. He really had a lot of control over the Andy Griffith Show. Tell us how that came about.
Well, there were four owners of the Griffith Show. It was a little different back then, a lot different than it is today. These four owners would have been Danny Thomas, Sheldon Leonard, Andy Griffith, and Richard Link, Andy's manager. They borrowed the money to have the show produced, put on film, and then they would get reimbursed by CBS once it was shown on the air. And because Andy was part owner, he had a lot of say-so, and he was good at it. He was a great, he never wrote a script, but he was a great script consultant. He could fine-tune it to make it sound like the South, and he knew when an actor perhaps was right for a part. And if he was listening to the dialogue at the read-through each week, he'd say, you know, this doesn't sound like something that we would say in the South. And he was also so generous to the other cast members. During the read-through, if anybody, even Ron Howard, who was a minor, could come up with something that they thought could improve the character's lines or the script, Andy welcomed that.
Kind of
so
interesting,
he
though.
Really.
Well, forgive me for interrupting, but when he showed up at that the writers' meeting for the first couple of times, they weren't mm-hmm. so sure he was going to be a great consultant, right?
That's right. The Griffith Show did something a little bit differently. At the beginning of each season, all the writers, this is interesting too, they were never on staff. The writers were freelance writers. So they might write an Andy show this week and then write Dick Van Dyke the next week. But the writers that had a aptitude to write for the Andy Griffith Show were asked to come in by Aaron Rubin, who was the producer of the show, and the day-to-day producer, and they would sit down in a room and just throw out one-liners. Well, what if Opie has an imaginary friend? They talk about what those possibilities. And Andy would come and sit in the room. And at first, Harvey Bullock told me, he was one of the great writers of the show, we didn't much like Andy there. You know, we felt like the writers should be on stage. I mean, the actors should be on stage and the writers should be in the script room. But Andy made some gentle statements. He wasn't pushy. He might just suggest something. He laughed a lot at the other writers' suggestions. And then it wasn't long before the writers, if he wasn't there, would say, well, where's Andy? Go get him.
So what happens now in that time between the Andy Griffith Show, the end of his show, and Matlock? What's he doing?
He's doing, like I said, he tried movies. The first one, and this was with Universal, he had a five-year contract. He did a movie called Angel in My Pocket. It was about a Southern minister. It wasn't very successful. Then Universal came to him and said, why don't we team you back up with Don Knotts? And Andy said, I love Don, but I feel like that's going backward. So he asked his manager to get him out of the Universal deal, which he did. Then he went to CBS, and immediately he got $3.5 million a year. This would have been back in 1971 for 5 years without even a script that CBS saw. And that was going to be Headmaster. And then halfway through the season, it wasn't working. They changed some of the premise. It became The New Andy Griffith Show, and it lasted 1 year, and that was the end of that. He did a lot of made-for-TV movies. I was watching on the day after he died on TV, they were showing an appearance of his in Mod Squad and Hawaii Five-0, and eventually he got a made-for-TV movie called Diary of a Perfect Murder, and the character was Matlock. It was very popular with the audience when it was shown, and NBC wanted to pick it up as a series.
And it did, and it was successful, too. Although, Neil, you are a huge fan of the Andy Griffith Show, and not so much Matlock, right?
Well, I love the Andy Griffith Show, but I have never, ever watched an episode of Matlock all the way through.
I can do better than that. I've seen probably three.
And you're not a fan either,
no.
Right?
Well, it's one of those, you know, formula. It's a procedural, an episodic procedural legal thing, and it's completely formulaic, and it doesn't push the envelope in any way.
Well, we certainly are familiar with the character. Let's listen to this.
Boy, that's a beautiful bracelet. Nicky Tower gave you that, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
And on the underside, there's an inscription says to my only love, with love forever, Nicky. Right?
Yes, there is.
He gave a bracelet just like that to somebody else. And we traced it to a jeweler in Los Angeles. Nicky Tower bought not one, not two, but 12 of those bracelets. You were in love with him, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
My client overheard the fight you had with him when the bill for those bracelets accidentally came across your desk. You were furious, weren't you? And when you heard the two of them fighting, my client, Nicky Tower, you rented that motorcycle, stole his gun, waited in the alley the night of the premiere until the right moment, then roared by on that motorcycle, shot Nicky Tower 3 times, rode it into the back of a waiting van, parked in a garage, changed as quickly as possible, got back down to the street over the body so you could have your picture in the paper, all for revenge.
No!
Your Honor, he's doing it again. Mr. Matlock seems incapable of telling the difference between conjecture and proof.
I have proof, Your Honor.
There we go. We got Perry Mason on grits there, I think. But Neil, you say you couldn't. You really never watched a whole episode.
No, I love Andy, but I grew up watching him in Mayberry, and it's really difficult for me to watch him in another role. And I think part of that is because I wasn't watching the Andy Griffith Show for Andy only. He's a great actor, and he's the center. But you fall in love with the town and the people, and when they weren't there anymore. That was what I was going home for every week. See, watching it for me is going home.
Well, let's talk about that home. Right now I want to introduce Jewel M. Kutzer. Jewel was born and raised in Mount Airy at the same time as Andy Griffith. She is author of Memories of Mayberry, a nostalgic look at Andy Griffith's hometown. Jewel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Frank.
What was Mount Airy like in the 30s and 40s?
Well, I'll tell you, what it was like is what he showed on the show. One of the things he did for the show was he put the candlestick phone in the party line, and I'm telling you, 50s and 60s, we didn't have a candlestick phone anymore. The candlestick phone, the prices, all that stuff, Andy and them put in specifically to make it feel like you just said back in the 30s and 40s. But it was a small town, everybody knew everybody else, and it was so small that Reverend Mickey, who was the Moravian minister, he had his service early so he could bring some of the men down to Central Methodist where my family went, and that's how Andy ended up singing in our choir.
Wow.
And I used to sit on the front row, and he was cute, honey, all of us girls really liked him. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I had a crush on him in those days.
So you knew him, and you say you had a crush on him. What about the characters? Were those characters in the Andy Griffith Show pretty much people you knew in
Mount Airy? Well, they were composites. People always ask me all the time, do we have a town drunk? And I said, we had more than one. I can tell you that. But they didn't let himself out of the jail. Yeah. But I would watch the show, and I would see things I knew were just really true. For instance, Barney in the Choir, which is one of the most favorite episodes of everybody, what I see is what the choir singing. Welcome, Sweet Springtime. And I knew why that was there, because Miss Coleman, our music teacher, made us sing that song every solid year for 8 years, and we were so sick of it by the time we got to high school. I knew why Andy put it in. Because the writers would tell me when I talked to them in Mayberry days, they would say they'd come in with an outline, and then Andy would salt and pepper it with real things, and that's why the show feels so real. It's got real stuff in there.
Well, on the show, of course, Barney periodically will leave to fix a stop sign on Spring Street.
Oh, yeah, that's a real stop sign on Spring Street. I'm telling you, Spring Street's a very sharp, steep hill. And used to walk up Spring Street every morning going to Rodford Street Grammar School, where Andy and I both went to school, past Roy Hutchins Laundry. It's Roy's Laundry in the show. But in the wintertime, we'd have to close it off because we'd have too much snow on it. So cars couldn't go down. But then all the kids, they'd get the flexible flyers and tin and cardboard and whatever we could find and go down that hill. Somebody always ran that stop sign. And the police were always saying, why don't you kids pay more attention to where you're going? It was always a problem. In the spring, the young guys made those soapbox derbies cars, and they would go down Spring Street and aim for that stop sign. So I knew that was another the reason why Andy put that in the show.
Now, your grandfather was Justice of the Peace in Mount Airy.
Yes, so he was. And I have, let me take caveat here. I have no idea in the world why they decided to show Opie playing checkers with the policeman and playing in the jail, but that was my life experience.
Really?
My grandfather's, the courthouse, courtroom was upstairs with the police station, fire station were right next to one another on Moore Avenue, and he would leave me with the policeman playing checkers and eating junk food, and I would, he would go upstairs to the courtroom to do his judging, and I, if nobody's in the jail, I'd sneak in there and pretend I was locked up and some handsome little kid was going to come get me out.
maybe the sheriff. Maybe it was Andy
maybe
Griffith himself.
Maybe the sheriff. And by the way, back on this business about why it's in North Carolina, let me tell you why it's Mayberry. And this has been kind of a half of a secret, but it's in my book. There's a little, Andy's mother, Geneva Nunn, was born in a little hamlet of Virginia about 12 miles away that's known as Mayberry. It's not on the map, but right now today there's a good old-fashioned country store that's been there since 1892 called the Mayberry Trading Post. And when Andy used to go up to visit his his mother's parents, they'd send him down to the Mayberry Trading Post to pick up the mail, to pick up some bread, whatever. That's why it's Mayberry.
There really is a Mayberry.
Well,
there wasn't much crime in Mayberry. I don't know about the real Mayberry, but in the fictional Mayberry, not much. The occasional moonshine.
Listen, I can tell you about moonshine because my grandfather, in addition to being the peace, was also the U.S. Marshal. So when they would break up a still, they'd have to bring those guys in to be bound over to federal court in Winston-Salem. And so I've spent many nights sitting on the stairs watching these really interesting-looking characters be brought into my grandfather's living room because they'd just been broken up a still and they'd been arrested. And, yes, they would take them down to the Mount Airy Jail overnight if it was late in the afternoon, because then they'd take them down to Winston-Salem to federal court the next day. So we had a lot of moonshining going on.
So what does the Mount Airy Jail look like?
Actually, they've just refurbished it. Bless Hampton Inn's heart. Every year they do something special for local people, and Mount Airy Jail won to get a refurbishing. So it has two small cells in the back. It's a little smaller than what they show on the show, but believe me, it was a fun place to play when I was a little girl.
Yeah, if you're playing checkers and can lock yourself in and out, you were kind of the town Otis.
I didn't do that.
Junior version of that, in and out. What was it like for you to actually watch that TV show?
Oh, I just felt like I was home, you know. I just really felt that this was home for me. And I really, really appreciated Andy. My mother worked at Rockford Grammar School, so I went and saw Andy perform from his earliest times. In fact, I've got a picture in my book of both of us on stage together. I'm a Rockford stage. I think I'm about 4 years old, and I got my fingers in my mouth, and that good-looking guy with big ears is standing behind me. So, you know, I used to hang around backstage when he was in high school, hoping he'd pay some attention to me. He was always kind. He was always pleasant, but he didn't pay no attention to me.
And did you ever meet up with him after he became a star?
No, not really. I heard him when he came to Mayberry Days. And he talked, actually, when he came in for the TV Land, when they put that statue up. He explained that he really was a lot of Mount Airy and Mayberry, and that, in fact, the producers had come in and taken pictures all around the town. They had talked to people. They'd interviewed people before that first episode was ever written.
So, Neil, what do you think is his legacy? What is his contribution to the world of entertainment?
I think when you think of Andy, you think of happiness. Devotion, his fans are so devoted to the Andy Griffith Show and his other work, too. But he gave us a lot of happiness, a lot of good memories. And the good thing is we can go back and watch them anytime we want to.
Mary, how about you?
Well, of course, I have to say I only like the black and white episodes. But I think in terms of sitcoms, that there is a sort of there are very high production values, the single camera approach, and then too, it's just that timeless quality.
And he may have introduced bluegrass music to all of us because music was such an important part. We hear people sing whole songs and play. So as we leave our conversation today, we'll hear some of the bluegrass music that actually was featured on the Andy Griffith Show. But first, I want to thank my guest, Mary Dalton, a professor of communication at Wake Forest University, co-editor of the sitcom Reader, America Viewed and Skewed, Neil Brower, a Methodist minister and author of Mayberry 101, Behind the Scenes of a TV Classic, and Jewel M. Kutzer is a writer, motivational speaker, and author of Memories of Mayberry, a nostalgic look at Andy Griffith's hometown. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.